In Washington, there is no longer positive talk of the Arab Spring. They are now calling it the Arab upheaval, and for once they got it right. Yesterday, a plucky army of rebels effectively brought to an end the 42-year reign of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, who has almost as many spellings of his name as he has costume changes. They could not have done it, however, without the help of hundreds of bombing runs over Tripoli by U.S. and NATO warplanes that reportedly took a heavy toll of the civilians they were supposed to protect, or without arms and weapons training provided by a handful of European and Middle Eastern countries, in particular British Special Forces. Having closely embraced by Washington and Europe's old colonial powers, Britain and France, what the future will be for Libya and for Libya's rebels once Gaddafi is gone, one can only speculate, and that will be the subject, of course, of a future program. There is one relationship in the Middle East that on the surface seems to be impermeable to change, and that's the one we are going to be examining at about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak once again with Palestinian professor Mazen Kumsia in Bethlehem about the latest critical developments in the Israel-Palestine conflict. There'll be much to talk about. The well-publicized plan of the Palestinian Authority to gain recognition of Palestinian statehood at the upcoming meeting of the UN in New York next month, and how that is being seen by Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. The recent announcement by the Israeli government that it will accelerate the expansion of Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank, which includes East Jerusalem, and how Palestinians in the West Bank view the recent protest by hundreds of thousands of Israelis against their own deteriorating economic conditions. We will for sure also be talking about Israel's arrest of scores of Palestinians in the West Bank and deadly air attacks on Gaza in the wake of an ambush that took the lives of 8 Israeli civilians and soldiers in the resort town of Eilat across Egypt's Sinai border by what Israel claimed to be Palestinian militants from Gaza. Israel's aerial assault took the lives of 15 Palestinians and wounded 40. The dead include the leaders of the Popular Resistance Committee, or PRC, the group that Israel, without any evidence, accused of launching the attack. This led, as was no doubt expected, to a renewal of rocket fire from Gaza into southern Israel, and the predictable denunciations of the Palestinians by some of Israel's trained SEALs in Congress. Yossi Gurvitz, writing on the dissident Israeli website 972, that's the international phone code for Jerusalem, points out that, quote, Israel has never supplied any proof that the attack originated in the Gaza Strip, end quote. He also noted that the PRC denied it was involved. What was curious was that Lieutenant Colonel Avital Leibovitz, the Israel military's chief spokesperson to the international media, denied in an interview posted on YouTube that Israel had blamed the PRC for the attacks. Leibovitz said she was not responsible for what the prime minister said, but claimed that the attackers did come from Gaza, citing as proof the fact that they were using Kalashnikov assault rifles. I don't know how to put it to Colonel Leibovitz, writes Yossi Gurvitz, but Kalashnikovs are the most common light assault rifle in the world, a gift that keeps on giving from the defunct Soviet Union, and they are rather easy to get all over the Middle East, end quote. What may have been the most important aspect of the attack on Eilat was the killing by Israeli soldiers of 3 Egyptian policemen who were responding to the attack. This set off the latest diplomatic furor between the new Mubarak-less Egypt and Israel, which saw its ambassador fleeing the country as angry protesters surround the Israeli embassy, one of them scaling the walls to replace the Israeli flag with that of Egypt. What was more significant was Cairo's threat to withdraw its own ambassador from Tel Aviv unless Israel issued a public apology, something Israel is on principle loath to do. But this time it did. Glenn Greenwald, writing on the Salon website, pointed to the significance of the Israeli apology. Quote, the threat of recalling its ambassador, Greenwald writes, led to what the New York Times called a, quote, unquote, rare statement of regret from Israel in order to placate growing Egyptian anger. Quote, unquote, rare because under the U.S. Mubarak Egyptian the U.S.-backed Mubarak, Egyptian public opinion was rendered inconsequential, and the Egyptian regime's allegiance was to Israel, meaning Israel never had to account for such acts, let alone apologize for them. In that regard, Greenwald points out, consider this superbly, if unintentionally, revealing phrase from the New York Times about this incident. Quote, By removing Mr. Mubarak's authoritarian but dependently loyal government, wrote a Times reporter, the revolution has stripped away a bulwark of Israel's position in the region, unleashing the Egyptian public's pent-up anger at Israel over its treatment of the Palestinians at a time when a transitional government is scrambling to maintain its own legitimacy in the streets, end quote. That word loyal makes the phrase remarkable, notes Greenwald. To whom was Mubarak loyal? Not to the Egyptian people whom he was governing, or even to Egypt itself, but rather to Israel and the United States. Thus, continues Greenwald, thus in the past, Egypt's own government would have sided with a foreign nation to which it was loyal, even when that foreign nation killed its own citizens and refused to apologize, exactly as the U.S. did when Israel killed one of its own citizens on the Mavi Marmara, and then again over the prospect that Israel would do the same with the new Gaza flotilla. In contrast to Turkey, which, acting like a normal government, was bitterly furious with Israel, and still is, over the wanton killing of its citizens. In that sense, the U.S. is just as, quote-unquote, dependently loyal as the Mubarak regime was. That's Glenn Greenwald writing on Salon.com, and why you'll never see his byline on the op-ed pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal, because he tells it like it is. Meanwhile, Syria, a far more critical player geopolitically than is Libya, continues to confound not only its traditional opponents with its bloody crackdown on that country's dissidents, such as the U.S. and Israel, but also close allies like Turkey, which has made a major effort to end the daily carnage. But Bashar al-Assad, who left his life as an ophthalmologist in London to take over the reins of Syria following the death of his father, Hafez al-Assad, has proved just as stubborn as Gaddafi, insisting that the protests in that country are the work of outsiders. A little over a week ago, he received words of support from a source that must have been deeply troubling to Washington. On August 12th, the New York Times reported that, quote, as leaders in the Arab world and other countries condemn Bashar al-Assad's violent crackdown on demonstrators in Syria, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq has struck a far friendlier tone, urging the protesters not to sabotage the state and hosting an official Syrian delegation. Mr. Maliki's support for Mr. Assad has illustrated how much Iraq's position in the Middle East has shifted toward an axis led by Iran, the article continued. And it also aggravated the fault line between Iraq's Shiite majority, whose leaders have accepted Mr. Assad's account that al-Qaeda is behind the uprising, and the Sunni minority, whose leaders have condemned the Syrian crackdown, end quote. Al-Maliki's stand in support of the Syrian regime comes ironically as Iraq and the U.S. are discussing the desire of the U.S. to be asked by Iraq to maintain a U.S. troop presence in that country after the previously agreed departure date, which is the end of 2011. On my last program, I reported that 81 members of Congress, or about one-fifth of the House of Representatives, elected to take a free trip to Israel rather than spend the bulk of their congressional recess dealing with the real problems of their constituents back home, courtesy of the American Israel Education Foundation, which is a phony front set up by AIPAC in order to get by, go through a loophole in congressional legislation, outlawing lobbying groups sending congressmen on foreign trips. Well, one of these congressmen, Pat Mahan, a freshman Republican congressman from Pennsylvania and chairman of the House Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence, that's in his first year in Congress, he decided to tell his constituents about his trip to Israel on his personal blog, but he didn't get the results he was expecting. After a posting appeared on the Mondo Weiss blog containing 7 of 154 fiercely critical comments, Representative Mahan erased each and every one. The only ones surviving are the ones on the Mondo Weiss blog, and the most popular one posted on Representative Mahan's site was by a man named Michael Rivero, who wrote, quote, no government can serve two masters, and a government that served Israel cannot serve the American people. A friend to Israel is no friend to America. America needs leaders who will put America first, second, and third, Please remember who you're supposed to work for and represent, wrote Rivero. This election, I make it my one mission that every politician who screams about how much they love Israel will be voted out of office so that they are free to go live there for the rest of their lives, end quote. Well, speaking of Congress, in case you haven't heard, Mendocino voters will be electing a new representative in 2012. No, Mike Thompson's not retiring. He's been redistricted and will be representing Napa and Solano counties, while Mendocino will now be in the same district as Sonoma and Marin, whose current representative, Lynn Woolsey, one of the relatively more progressive members of the House, is retiring. It will be the first contested election for the office in years, at least in the Democratic primaries. Well, you didn't get this on All Things Considered, excuse me, yesterday, as likely you won't get many more details elsewhere concerning yesterday's 5.9 earthquake in Virginia and its effect on the state's North Anna nuclear plant at Lake Anna in Louisa County. Among the 104 nuclear plants in the United States, the Virginia facility with its two reactors was rated the seventh most at risk by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and was designed to withstand a quake only up from 5.9 to 6.1 on the Richter scale. At 3:43 East Coast time yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the plant, quote, has lost off-site power and is now using four diesel generators to maintain cooling operations, and the plant had automatically shut down in the wake of the earthquake. As far as I know, everything is safe, said Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesperson David McIntyre. 2 hours later, it was reported that one of the generators had failed, but it was not considered an emergency. In addition, the NRC announced that, quote, there are seven additional nuclear plants that have declared unusual events, which is the lowest of four emergency situations, end quote. Well, that's comforting. 20 years ago, on March 16, 1991, following a quake in the area that measured 3.6, the Virginia Freelance Star editorialized that, quote, the fault line that lies between the two nuclear reactors at the North Anna nuclear power plant remains a cause for concern. That particular fault was discovered in 1970, goes the paper noted, when the plant was under construction, but was not reported until 1973 to the Atomic Energy Commission. Scientists have said that the fault is dead, but Professor Donald Day, a University of Virginia physics professor, isn't convinced, end quote. The editorial wondered whether there was cause for alarm and answered its own question by suggesting that, quote, sloughing off the issue would be irresponsible, end quote. I would hazard a guess that's what they did. Professor Day is currently a research professor in experimental nuclear and particle physics at Virginia University, and we expect he will soon weigh in again on this issue. I sent him an email last night hoping I could get a comment from him by today's program, but I did not receive anything yet. On my last program, I reported that the city of Ukiah is considering a proposal by Walmart to expand its current 109,000 square feet operation in the Airport Boulevard Shopping Center by two-thirds, or an additional 52,000 square feet, and remain open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as a full-service grocery and liquor store. The section of the draft EIR, which dealt with the likely impact on local grocery stores that was posted on the Planning Commission's website, concluded that, quote, the project would not result in long-term commercial building vacancies and therefore would not result in increased urban decay conditions, end quote. Quite astonished at this conclusion and the way that C.B. Richard Ellis, the company making that assessment, arrived at it, led me to suspect something shady was afoot. So I Googled Walmart plus C.B. Richard Ellis. And what did I find? That C.B. Richard Ellis, the world's largest real estate operation, brags on its website that, quote, CBRE Portfolio Services has sold 197 assets on behalf of Walmart, end quote. Which, need I add, is the world's largest commercial retailer. In other words, C.B. Richard Ellis is Walmart's real estate agent. Now, one would think this would represent an obvious conflict of interest, but no. Not in the good old USA, where corporations are persons, and what is judged to be outright bribery in any other country is considered free speech, and where corporations write the laws that govern their conduct. Thus, the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, has determined that there is no conflict of interest when a company, in this case C.B. Richard Ellis, prepares an environmental impact report that can benefit a company with which it has a long-standing and profitable business relationship, namely Walmart. But there is a question of ethics. As I learned from speaking with both Planning Commissioner Charlie Stump and City Planner Kim Jordan, that until I told them, neither was aware or had been informed by either Walmart or C.B. Richard Ellis of their cozy relationship when the commission selected the latter from a list of consultants to advise the city on the impact of the proposed Walmart expansion on a community that already is oversaturated with supermarkets. Those of you who are interested in getting additional information on the Walmart expansion project or getting involved can read both the draft environmental impact report plus the written critical comments, including one from myself, that have been submitted to the Planning Commission by going to its website, cityofukiah.com. And a new organization has formed, which you'll hear more about, called Citizens for Sustainable Commerce, which is also opposing the Walmart expansion.